We have met to receive insights forthcoming from the Wellbeing Index project. In fact, in March 2021, just 2 years ago, in this very room, we presented the baseline indicators on the subject well-being in Malta. We need then that while the Maltese demonstrated average levels of life satisfaction at par with the other European counterparts, their self-assessed satisfaction with time use, however, was lower. We also noted that certain conditions like ill health and severe material deprivation were clearly related with lower levels of well-being, defined by any metric, be it life satisfaction, happiness, or anxiety. Later, we were presented with a range of objective indicators and dashboards, which also shed light on life in Malta and well-being. We noted then that the conditions in Malta were indeed conducive to high levels of well-being compared to many other countries all over the globe, in the world, as also demonstrated by Malta's rankings on various scoreboards. Yet, in comparison to other European counterparts, we could do better on various fronts. In this and the other initiatives that the Malta Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society has brought to Parliament, the Foundation has effectively become, I would say, Malta's watchdog for well-being issues. Today, I'm looking forward to the project providing new data as well as direction or where we have to go with this information. However, I would like to conclude with a wonderful quote that I came across while preparing my presentation by an American philosopher, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and I feel that I should refer it today, and I quote, "The purpose of life is to be useful, to be honorable, to be compassionate, to have it make some difference that you have lived and lived well." Thank you very much. Now we'll start with the packed agenda. We have an hour, and I immediately give the floor to the Her Excellency President Emeritus Marius Colliera Preca.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and good morning to everyone here. Happiness is interlinked with well-being. It is for this reason that the Malta Foundation for the Well-being of Society, together with the University of Malta, chose to celebrate the International Day of Happiness by meeting here today to share some further insights and updates on the development of a well-being index for Malta. It has been just over a decade when the United Nations General Assembly invited countries to pursue happiness and well-being when developing their public policies for all peoples without prejudice. The United Nations resolution specifically said, and I quote, "Conscious that the pursuit of happiness is a fundamental human goal, recognizing also the need for a more inclusive, equitable, and balanced approach to economic growth that promotes sustainable development, poverty eradication, happiness, and the well-being of all peoples," end quote. Since then, the United Nations has invited all member states, organizations of the United Nations system, and other international and regional organizations, as well as civil society organizations and individuals, to observe the International Day of Happiness in an effective manner through education and public awareness-raising activities. So it is for these reasons that the Malta Foundation for the Well-being of Society in 2019 took the bold decision to pursue the development of a well-being index for Malta. Today's event aims to bring to you new insights from the Wellbeing Index project, which constitutes the long-standing efforts of the Malta Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society to advocate for the necessary changes in our society by making the well-being of our children, families and communities a priority. It has been our mission to highlight that well-being is tantamount to the well-deserved dignity of each and every one of us in our society, whoever we may be. It has been our commitment to help in developing a rights-based approach to national policies and action plans to ensure well-being for all. It has been our aim ever since to advocate to place the multidimensional concept of well-being at the heart of Malta's vision and policies. Happiness and life satisfaction is a right to be safeguarded and which all of humanity should enjoy. Therefore, since the setting up of the Malta Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society as early as 2014, we have argued that we need regular and robust national well-being statistics to compare the well-being of different segments of Maltese society over time and with other countries to guide and inform policy. As back as 2018, the Foundation engaged with the National Statistics Office to start the collation of data that would be important and essential for the visibility and the monitoring of the well-being situation of the people of these islands. What we share with you today is the fruit of that vision and mission. Through the data and through the work of the Foundation on the ground, we have become increasingly aware that there were marked differences in the quality of life and the well-being enjoyed by all members of our society. Our work reflects on the inequitable access to physical and mental health, to income and employment, to family and social interaction, to levels of education and skills, to freedom of expression and engagement, to leisure, to environmental quality and open spaces, and other benchmarks of well-being. We will hear about some factual disparities in life satisfaction and well-being in Malta from our researchers later on. At the Malta Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society, we also go beyond academic and scientific research. We are believers of participation processes, and therefore we also work on initiatives on the ground with the hope of bringing together the collective popular wisdom of the people of these islands. We also believe that in this way, all strata of society will be contributing to their well-being by informing our advocacy work for a more and equal society. I will therefore take the opportunity today to mention a few examples of our work on the ground, in particular about the work we do with and for children and young people, also within the family setting and the community at large. Let me start with Project Comunitaria, where we heard children express the need for green, open and safe spaces in the community through a three-tier consultation process with the participation of over 900 children coming from across Malta and Gozo. Another project, which we called Safe Space, Alken in Maltese, is the development of a mobile app to help young people manage their emotions and to reduce urges to self-harm. This app includes a mood diary, a toolbox of evidence-based techniques to reduce the stress, and an automatic routing towards support services available, including emergency services for young people in Malta. Again, this foreshadows the findings, which sadly are echoed in our experience on the ground, with the Blossom Project, led by the Malta Trust Foundation, another foundation which I chair, and which provides counseling services in schools. We are overwhelmed with a diverse array of presenting issues. We are concerned by children as young as 9 years who are already struggling with serious mental health challenges. The Wellbeing Index project is at this moment concluding the collection of data on children aged 7 to 8 and 9 to 16, which we will present later this year. A notable project that is worth mentioning is the Children's Manifesto, which brought together years of child participation processes. This is the result of a strong and reliable study of children's aspirations in Malta. In fact, 1 in 5 children living on these islands participated and contributed to these processes. The Children's Manifesto includes 99 tangible proposals, which have been enforced by academic evidence in a collaborative project led by the led by the Children's Rights Observatory Malta, which is a relatively newly founded entity between the Malta Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society and the Faculty for Social Wellbeing of the University of Malta. We are believers of collaboration, and therefore we have also set up a number of collaborative networks over the years to lend a strong voice to the diverse groups and target their challenging circumstances. We have set up the Rainbow Families Network in collaboration with Malta Gay Rights Movement, aiming at bringing together LGBTIQ plus families and their children to create the much needed support and awareness for these children, for these families, and in particular their children. We have set up Empower, which is a network for all organizations on the islands that work with and for gender equality. Spark 15 is a youth refugee-led NGO that targets specific challenges that young refugees face in our society, a migrant-led NGO platform aiming at offering a unique space whereby migrant-led NGOs could come together in a safe space to strengthen their voice. Malta Can is a network that brings together national organizations that work with and for children, aiming at highlighting the importance of safeguarding children's rights and the necessary investment in children for a better today and a resilient society tomorrow. We have targeted some of the most vulnerable communities whose well-being demands particular focus. This is where the importance of this segregated data comes in. Overall, the Malta Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society aims to work towards a society where all people may enjoy quality of life. Today, thanks to the Malta Wellbeing Index Project, a collaboration between the Foundation together with the University of Malta, we have the data at hand to assess whether the diverse people of these islands are effectively enjoying quality of life and well-being. It is our aim to highlight the importance of securing and safeguarding equality and equity. The Malta Wellbeing Index Project aims to be an ongoing reality check, as inequalities should not grow wider. We aim to reinforce our belief in securing an economy for the people and not a people for the economy. As a society, we need to earnestly work for the necessary transformative action to effectively address inequality and inequity amongst us. I look forward to hearing our able principal investigator, Dr. Mari Briguglio, and her team share the outcomes of this year's work with you. Finally, I must convey my heartfelt appreciation to Dr. Mari Briguglio and her team of researchers, our partner, the University of Malta, all of our collaborators, in particular the National Statistics Office and other entities, Ms. Stephanie Zammit, our newly appointed director, and the team at the Malta Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society. To you, Mr. Speaker, and your team at Parliament for housing us repeatedly, members of the media, and last but not least, to the members of the Board of Administrators of the Foundation, who have been so supportive as from our first discussion and decision to take on board this important project. Thank you.
Thank you. Your Excellency, Mr. Pega. Now I call Professor Carmen Samut, Director of the University of Malta, to deliver her presentation on the role of research of the well-being policy.
Happiness, il-kuntentizza. U ħanibda ngħid ftit kelmtejn bil-Maltin mbagħad inkompli mill-paper tiegħi bl-Ingliż. Għaliex kulħadd jipprova jgħix kuntent, il-kuntentizza tqal emozjoni pożittivi, imma il-kuntentizza hija wkoll xi ħaġa suġġettiva, għalija sempliċiment mhix hija mal-kelb ma sbieħli jum tagħmilni kuntent tal-komplement tal-ġurnata mal-oħrajn tista' tkun attività li iswa bħala kedda żejda. Il-kuntentizza hija influenzata ma' fatturi varji li jinkludu relazzjonijiet tagħna mal-oħrajn, il-valuri personali tagħna, u dak li tibatilna il-ħajja inklusi s-saħħa, is-soddisfazzjon li nieħdu mix-xogħol, il-possibilità li nikbru u li naċċettaw li nafusna kif aħna bil-kwalitajiet tajbin u bid-difetti tagħna. L-istudju li qegħdin naraw illum jindika li nistgħu wkoll nikkwantifikaw dawn l-emozzjonijiet u nkejluhom fuq livell nazzjonali. il-metodologija u l-variables li ntazlu jistgħu ħallu impatt fuq ir-riżultati iżda dawn huma variables li jippermettu analiżi komparattiva. U allura ir-riżultati komplessi ta' dan l-istudju akademiku għandhom jiġu eżaminati anke fl-istituzzjoni bħalma hija il-Parlament, anke minħabba l-implikazzjonijiet importanti għal policy. Xi ħaġa pożittiva li bdejna morru lil-lin mid-diskussjoni tas-soltu dwar l-standard of living, dwar il-kwalità tal-ħajja dak li għajdu l-pols, biex nifmu aħjar l-esperjenza umana fil-profondità kollha tagħha. So, ahead of the presentations of actual insights from this project, allow me to share a few thoughts on the role of research more generally in well-being policy. This may seem obvious considering the role of the University of Malta and the heavy presence of academics in today's meeting. But while evidence-based policy is often talked about, it's far less often acted upon, particularly in a field where the subject matter has only become the concern of policy and research in recent years. My first insight is drawn from the latest edition of Gallup's World Happiness Report 2022. This documents the level of interest in the topic of happiness and subjective well-being by examining the frequency of these words in books in multiple global languages, by looking at the scale of published research and at the number of government measurement initiatives. By all accounts, interest in well-being has been rising. Since the turn of the century, there has been a tenfold increase in research output on happiness. Academic research on happiness now involves authors from all over the world. What started in North America, Western Europe, and Australia is now a much more global endeavor. China, Turkey, Slovakia, South Korea, India, and Taiwan are now in the top 20 countries producing research on well-being. A cursory glance at our own open access repository at the University of Malta reveals many relevant publications with well-being, happiness, and or life satisfaction as a key word in their titles. You can find these linked on the Wellbeing Index website. My second point is that the increased data and research will come to expect increased application in policy. This suggests that while data and indicators must reflect the science in the sense of being valid and reliable, they must also communicate well with policymakers and resonate with the public, not to mention fulfilling the practical considerations of data availability, expense, etc. This is something that I'm sure my colleagues have kept in mind in identifying the kind of metrics to use for well-being. My third and final point is that while there are several well-documented correlates of well-being, which provide important pointers for intervention, there is one type of intervention that contributes to all others. That is research on well-being itself. Understanding what makes people feel satisfied and happy, where the inequalities lie, who is suffering, and how to intervene, constitutes, arguably, the key contribution of well-being in the lives of people in Malta. There are also signs that well-being research will benefit from development in academia elsewhere. From automated text analysis used to measure emotions online, to the use of biomarkers to gauge well-being, as a university, we have a responsibility to cultivate a culture of collaboration and break down barriers that hinder progress. Through interdisciplinary research, we can make meaningful contributions to our communities and improve the well-being of our society. In short, the science of well-being is growing, as is its application to policy. This is an exciting transdisciplinary area of research with huge potential to make a real world impact. With this satisfying and happy thought, I now give the floor to the next speaker.
Thank you, Professor Kamel Samoul. Now I call Mr. Matthew Zarafa, Director General of the NSO.
Thank Thank you, Mr. Speaker, Your Excellency, distinguished guests. The National Statistics Office acknowledges the importance of economic growth and will continue to invest in advancement in this area of statistics. Having said that, the NSO recognizes that to truly understand how the recent considerable progress in our economy is impacting our lives, we must not regard the GDP as the overriding statistic of importance, but must couple it with other key areas such as the environment, employment, education, poverty, and well-being. This is the reason why these disciplines are growing in significance and are ever more visible in the NSO's statistical output. The NSO is the main producer of official statistics in Malta. Today, thanks to a combination of effort by NSO staff and other parties, such as Dr. Maria Briguglio and her team, important indicators on well-being are being produced, rendering a highly relevant service to policymakers. Today, with socioeconomic data derived from the survey on income and living conditions, various social surveys, and administrative records, these indicators feed important dashboards, including the EU Sustainable Development Goals dashboard, Eurostat's Quality of Life dashboard, and the EU Silk Wellbeing module, to mention some. Most of these statistics are based on large samples, and therefore are very reliable. The methodology used is consistent and harmonized across the EU, enabling comparability with other member states. However, the challenges which a statistician faces when collecting data on well-being are many, be it to allow for subjectivity when asking people for their well-being and health status, or to build a realistic picture of situations when measuring indicators such as material deprivation or the number of persons at risk of poverty. Some of these challenges are the high cost of surveys. Collecting data directly from households is very expensive due to several factors. Moreover, the need for high-quality statistics necessitates surveying relatively large samples when compared to the size of our population, which continues to increase costs. The response burden on respondents to surveys. Excessive response burden can lead to low response rates, as respondents may be unwilling or unable to devote the necessary time and effort to complete the survey. This can compromise the quality of the data collected. The completeness of administrative data. While some administrative data exists, it is often not complete or is not in line with the standards needed for high-quality statistics. Our competing priorities. The NSO is constantly required to deal with new data demands, which cannot be addressed due to limited resources. Many of these demands are regulated at the EU level, leaving little room for innovative initiatives like this project. Another challenge is the underrepresentation of migrants and certain population subgroups. For example, Census 2021 has shown that foreigners make up more than 20% of the Maltese population. It is challenging for our office to gather comprehensive data on these groups because response rates among foreigners are typically lower than those among Maltese citizens. And sampling errors. EU-SILC collects information from approximately 4,000 households and nearly 10,000 individuals on an annual basis. Despite this considerable sample size, some detailed breakdowns still cannot be produced due to high sampling errors. Turning a blind eye to these quality problems when interpreting results will ultimately result in fluctuations which at times do not make sense and therefore are unexplainable. It is not, however, only a story of hard challenges. The NSO has grown skillful in turning challenges into opportunities. Last month, the NSO published the first set of results from the 2021 census. The census is an important new baseline for social surveys, which will be instrumental in helping us address undercoverage of certain population subgroups. The modernization of statistics in the form of creation of a data warehouse and the replacement of manual processes with automated ones. This will certainly improve efficiency, accuracy, and timeliness. The inclusion of the well-being module in EU-SILC, which will provide time series data and eventually the possibility for longitudinal analysis. So to conclude, one of the ambitions of office statistics providers such as the NSO is to see academics, researchers, and policymakers use its statistical products. From this angle, we are happy and encouraged to observe that the Wellbeing Index project is not only laying the foundation for accelerated collection of data, but is also enlarging its potential as a useful instrument to support data visualizations, disseminations, and research applications. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we come to the updates of the Wellbeing Index project together with the University of Malta, and I call first Dr. Maria Briguglio.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, Excellency, and distinguished guests.
I plan to do two things in my presentation. The first is to recap on what the project is about very briefly, and the second is to give you the latest insights from the data coming out of the project. Before I start, I once again remind you this is a collaboration between the Malta Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society and the University of Malta. And I also take the opportunity to thank the National Statistics Office because, as you will see later in this presentation, without their support and capacity to collect large data, we wouldn't have the material to work with. Okay, so the first year of our work was focused on looking at well-being inequalities in Malta. We looked at a sample of about 9,000 individuals and how they manifested their well-being with different metrics, and we also broke down this data by different socio-economic groups. As mentioned by Mr. Speaker earlier, we found, for example, things like people with high material deprivation to experience low well-being, however you measure it. We also found that there are many other findings, which I won't repeat. We also, at that stage, constructed an econometric model of well-being capable of forecasting who is likely to have low well-being when all is considered. In the second year, we then focused on a dashboard of well-being indicators by looking at various international efforts in this regard and the sub-indicators that they include. We compared how Malta does by any international metric we could find, obviously starting with GDP, but also extending to many others. The EU Quality of Life, SDG Dashboard, Human Development Index, and so forth. And we brought all this together on a website which acts as a one-stop shop. And here I'd like to thank Glenn and, Joelle Latsopardi primarily, and Glenn Spiteri for their assistance to making this website possible. Now we're in the sort of start of the third year, and our aim is to bring to you some findings from the state of the art of policy review from other countries, that is beyond the statistics, what countries are actually doing to bring this forward into policy. We'll hear a presentation by Professor Tsopardi and Dr. Portelli later on. We also are working to look at the well-being of children. This year, the Center for Resilience and Social-Emotional Health, ably led by Professor Karm Chafai, is collecting data in this regard. We will present this to you later this year. And we're also going to bring you the well-being updates from these past years, and this is what I'm going to present to you now. Okay, so the headline finding is that between 2018 and 2021, there was a statistically significant drop in life satisfaction. This is very clear. There is very little ways to misinterpret this. The drop is not only significant, but also the whisker, which is the extent to which there is variation around this mean, is also larger. This means we have experienced a decline in life satisfaction, and we are experiencing more inequality in life satisfaction. Beyond this headline, we see, first of all, I will start with the good news, enhanced financial satisfaction, at least following the dip that occurred a couple of years ago, and rising job satisfaction. We were already high on these, and they continue to grow. Okay, so there is little doubt that on the finance and work side, a finding repeated by various statistics, we are doing well, at least on average. Now, when you disaggregate, you, of course, find problem pockets which need to be addressed, but on average, this is repeatedly a happy statistic. We also observe that there was an incline in trust. Okay, we noticed that on average, people are expressing a higher degree of trust in others. However, we notice in parallel an increase in loneliness. It is important to stress at this stage that we are here looking at the trends between 2018 and 2021. And we all know what happened in this period. Okay, this wasn't a particularly happy time for any country. But we still must, doesn't matter what the circumstances were, what matters is what we're going to do about them. Now, I turn to some disaggregations of this data. And the first thing I want to look at is the regional differences in well-being. And the headline statistic here is that the North Harbour's area experiences significantly lower life satisfaction in 2021. You can see that horizontal line there, which is drawn to reflect the North Harbour's average. This is interesting because the North Harbour is not only the most densely populated, but also the most populous. It's the place where most people live. Okay, so this definitely merits some attention. Aware that I'm going to have some thin text in my next slide, I'm going to scoot over and bring... my specs. I seem to have switched it off as well. So now I can't see a thing. There we go. Okay. All right. So some regional differences. As I mentioned, the North Harbours demonstrate the lowest level of satisfaction on average, not just with their life, but also with their finance and their job situation. It bears mention that contrary to notions that the North Harbour's area is just Sliema, which it isn't, it also includes places as diverse as Birkirkara, Ormi, and so forth. Okay, so really it's where most people live. It's also the area with the lowest disposable income on average, and material deprivation is also higher than average. On the other hand, Gozo demonstrates as the region with the highest satisfaction with jobs, with finance, and with life in general. But when it comes to how frequently people reported feeling happy, please note the difference between this cognitive assessment of life satisfaction and emotions, Gozitans report feeling less happy, or feeling happy less frequently than others. People in the Southern Harbour return an average of feeling the most frequently nervous, the most frequently downhearted and depressed, and the most frequently lonely. Again, we're talking averages here. There is low trust in others on average, I mean, when we compare to other countries across the board, but Gozo demonstrates the highest trust and the lowest trust is in the southeastern region. And perceived social exclusion is lowest in the South Harbour area. We also noticed there were major regional redistributions between 2018 and 2021. And this could be an artifact of at least two factors. The first is that people moved around, and the second is that conditions in these regions became different. So, for example, we observed a higher congestion in the North Harbour's area. So, you know, when you're dealing with data sets of these magnitudes and you're still at the averages level, you can't really go wrong. They really are a dipstick into what's going on. We also notice some gender differences. The differences are not large numerically, but they are statistically significant. They carry through in almost every indicator, whereby males are significantly more satisfied with their lives. They're more satisfied with their financial situation. They feel nervous less frequently than females. They are less likely to be downhearted and depressed than females. They are less likely to be lonely than females. They are more likely to feel calm and peaceful than females. And they are more likely to feel happy more frequently than females. The only area where females seem to do better is with their satisfaction with working, satisfaction with their job, and in their personal relationships. These findings are consistent, persistent. They are not large, so we're talking about a point after the integer, so like between 7.1 and 7.2, for example, or even less at times. But they are persistent. And then we look at the age differences. Now, here I drew the horizontal line with the lowest being the 65+. And we observe that between 2018 and 2021, the elderly experienced a considerable drop in their life satisfaction, so that now they are those people with the lowest average life satisfaction. In 2018, we had observed that those under 18 were the most satisfied with their lives and the 65+ the least satisfied, so we saw an age gradient. But at least at that point, the 65 and over were the most satisfied with their financial situations. Those that worked, which were very satisfied with working, they were satisfied with their time use and their personal relationships. In fact, they were among the most satisfied in Malta. Fast forward to 2021, we see that they are that this repeated pattern, that the under 18 are most satisfied and the over 65 least satisfied. But now we notice that they are the most likely to be downhearted and depressed, the least happy, the most lonely, and the most likely to face social exclusion. Not particularly shocking news. We knew that during COVID years they suffered a lot. There was the kind of shutdown for lockdown for the elderly. So this is reflecting that, but we really must do something to try and reverse it. I want to quickly tell you some findings from the World Happiness Report, because this was issued only last Monday. We await this like children await Christmas Eve, because it's kind of like where we see how Malta does. We slipped a few places in life evaluation compared to other countries, not many. We did better, even better than the very good position we had on GDP per capita. So again, the story repeats. Our life expectancy is still very high and retained our positions. We did a little better for feeling positive emotions, although we're still very, very low compared to the world average and considering how well we do on GDP. And we did even worse for negative emotions. At the moment, there are only 27 countries in the world which feel bad more frequently than the Maltese. Okay, this is showing our life satisfaction. I want to conclude so I don't take up more time. So what is this data telling us, apart from the fact that how nice it is to have data, that we must execute policy to promote improvements in other domains besides work and income, and we must disaggregate our data to see those members of society whose well-being is the lowest and to give them the opportunity to enhance the lives they live. And now I leave it to Professor Tsopardi to tell us about policy proposals. Thank you.
Professor and Dr. Tsopardi.
I must send to Alcom Wisp. Mari did all the exciting bits. So I'm left with very quickly. First of all, I find this exercise very interesting. And the innuendo that we tend to use, that entities don't work together, I think we have managed to break that. And I think this is a very important element, because well-being cannot be read in isolation, because that would be very, very dangerous. In fact, there's a lot of research being done Mari mentioned Carmel Cefai, but also a number of other academics within FEMA and our faculty, but also in other entities. And I must commend in particular the Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society, because it is one of the few NGOs, few organizations I know, that informs itself with policy and empirical data before actually acting. But not only that, then they actually act. And that is really important. The second thing is that a bit of a pat on the back. When we used to tell them that it's the Faculty for Social Wellbeing, we used to get a lot of giggles, because people would think that they're going off to a spa, and it's anything but. But with the contribution of the fact that the foundation is the Foundation for the Wellbeing of Society, the Faculty for Social Wellbeing, I think it has managed to break this misconception of what wellbeing is. And in fact, nowadays, we are slowly and gradually speaking about data, about a body of knowledge, about a corpus of knowledge circumventing on well-being. And this brings me to my bit very quickly, that that this idea that there is a lot of data out there is not true. I mean, even though we managed to bring in as much data as we could to the project, the truth is that Malta leads as a trailblazer in research, and this is one very important example, in research in the area of well-being. So I think we do merit a bit of a pat on the back as a country in this sense as well. I'll try not, well, I can't see that, obviously, because, sorry, Lisbon. Okay, method. Well, really, I don't want to bore you too much, but obviously we based a lot on having a structured literature review. We did not only collect data in isolation, numbers and statistics in isolation, but we also linked that with case studies, which I think is very, very important. And obviously we kept coming back to the local context, which we think is very important. And then recommendations, which I believe Charmaine will be speaking about in a moment. The global perspective, I think there are three important elements there. Governance, movement, and research. Governance, if I had to give an example, is the United Nations, European Union, OECD. The international movement is the Well-Being Economy Alliance, probably one of the most representative in this aspect. And the international research, there's the World Happiness Report. And I would dare say there's also this research as well that I'm sure will start featuring also in international fora, as it probably already does. We looked at a number of case studies, and you can see, well, you can't see probably, but I'll tell you, you'll have to trust me on this one. There were a number of countries that we drew from, which was very important, and what is very interesting is the variety of countries that we engage with. Bhutan, probably most of us had never heard of it before. Well, I hadn't before we did the study. New Zealand, obviously Malta, Germany, Iceland, Republic of Ireland, Canada, Ecuador. Very interesting differences, very engaging differences. Countries are in different places in terms of what they have achieved. If we had to look at Germany, they have there's national dialogue going on, and an independent team of scientists, the dimensions, indicators, which are helping Germany understand what is happening, and reports are presented regularly. So, well, Iceland could be another example where there is a steering committee, categories, indicators linked to SDGs, which I think is very, very important. This is one probably important element that we need to keep in mind, that there's a lot of work that has been done, and we need to start connecting the different elements. It is monitored by Statistical Iceland, and a number of fiscal strategy plans. Well, I think my bit is done, I believe, because I hand over to Charmaine, right? Okay, so I'll hand over to Charmaine. I do commend this initiative, and whilst I thank Dr. Mari Brigolio because she's spearheading this laborious job of getting people together, and academics, researchers, and statisticians are the worst sample when it comes to getting them together. But she has managed to do that in a very, 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 very good way. And I thank her. I thank our researchers, amongst which Olga, who has done loads of work in terms of this report. So I thank you very much, Mari in particular.
Dr. Charmaine Portelli.
Okay, thank you. So I'll take over and start with going through some key issues which we have identified, and then I put forward some key recommendations or proposals for consideration. So I start with some issues related to well-being measurement. First of all, we've come across a multidimensional approach Which combines the data about people's economic circumstances as well as data on material living conditions to come up with or cover a wide range of quality of life factors. So it's important we gathered from even from the case studies we consider that a multidimensional approach is very important. With regards to indicators, there are two classifications I've seen in the slide. So the objective and the subjective indicators, these are key information and very necessary for capturing the quality of life and incorporating them in well-being measurement tools. Now, again, based on the case studies considered, some focused on a composite index, whilst others take a more dashboard approach. And this latter approach, we've seen that it is the most common one and the more modern approach. Another key issue which we need to keep in mind when considering well-being measurement is the importance of disaggregation. This has been referred to in earlier presentations, how important it is to look at, for example, the age, the gender, the status, the, education, social status, etc. So rather than looking at the total and then an average, we disaggregate depending on the type of group we're looking at. And now I move on to looking at the policy cycle. Various countries took different approaches here. Some considered well-being policy at the formulation stage, others at the evaluation stage, and some even considered it as setting the as a guide to set the agenda. Whatever stage it is, the important thing is that it is actually used. So. That we actually use these indicators at the policies in a policy cycle, irrespective of whether it is at formulation stage or the other two points considered. Then another important point is about leadership. Again, from the case studies, we've seen that there isn't one straight conclusion we can reach about lead agencies. However, leadership was crucial among the case studies because obviously leadership motivates, builds trust and guides through change. Encourages the trust of the public if there is an element of leadership. Another issue which emerged very clearly from the case studies is that of consultation. It is key, consultation is key whilst determining the indicators. Consultation is important both for choosing the determinants as well as for a sense of ownership. Okay, so it has more than one phase, the importance of consultation. Now, the way consultation is done varies across the case studies. Some take a roundtable approach. Others take an online interactive dashboard or through reports. For example, cases such as Bhutan, New Zealand, Iceland, Northern Ireland emphasize on roundtables involving their experts and several committees. Again, we take these different approaches into consideration. What emerges very important is how, that consultation cannot be emphasized enough. So it's crucial. Moving on to well-being research. Research is still in its infancy. However, we should say that over the past 10 years, it have increased significantly. Despite that, there are still numerous research gaps. And I mentioned two here, one related to cross-cultural equivalence, so how to compare between countries and cultures, and another is about the research on vulnerable and minority groups. I put forward there some research recommendations. First of all, we continue learning from best practices as we've doing. Also supporting the ongoing work on international comparable compendium of methodology. So looking at different methodologies and learning from these methodologies. We support the scientific research approach to attain reliable data. And the last point I will recommending is to consider contextualizing the terminology in the Maltese language. So terms which we use, like well-being, for example, will have an equivalence terms in the Maltese language. Now I come to consider some key proposals. I start with integrating the concept of well-being into government's mission statement and agendas. We can learn here from the example of Ecuador, who systematically integrate well-being matrices in policy decision-making. Also, we empower a well-being center, watchdog, or key ambassador to guide and provide support to public and private sectors, advance on capacity building activities, maintain communication. Okay, so there are several roles which the well-being center can take. The ensure data collection structures are supported. Here we again refer to the National Statistics Office. Support towards these structures for reliable, regular measurement and monitoring of well-being data. Also, we are bridging data gaps, which are identified in local research so far. For example, related to mental health, homelessness, and specific subgroups of the population where data is lacking. We work on that aspect as well. Legislation, we embed well-being principles in countries' legislation, not having a specific legislation per se on well-being, but using well-being principles as a checklist for every legislation that is drafted. Think of parallels here, where every legislation is checklisted against EU principles once we are EU members. On the same lines, we can checklist our legislation vis-à-vis well-being principles. Also, budget allocations are planned according to the well-being principles. So we have the own budget, we have the EU budget as well. How these are allocated are to be in line, again, with well-being principles. Okay, some further proposals. Evaluate policy impact through a well-being lens. So every policy, whether directly related or not, that is drafted by policymakers should be seen from a well-being lens. This needs a good capacity building. So we deliver capacity building and training opportunities for key players involved in the implementation of well-being principles. We consult with citizens, research and experts. I've already touched upon consultation. I've already emphasized that every case study we considered emphasized consultation. So that should remain on our key proposal list. Also, educate citizens and children about well-being. So the well-being and well-being principles should be a term that everyone understands, starting from young children, obviously in collaboration with educators as well. And on the final point, communicate well-being trends data with the public. The more we communicate with the public, the more we earn their trust in this regard. So very quickly, I took you through some key proposals. for consideration. We will continue working on this project under the leadership of Dr. Mary Brigolio. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Charmaine Portelli. Now I call for the concluding remarks Stephanie Zammit, Director of the Mater World Foundation Wellbeing.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Distinguished guests, as we are nearing the end of this briefing session, allow me to say a few words on behalf of the Malta Foundation for the well-being of society to be able to conclude. It is part of the strategy of the Foundation to advance the measurement of well-being and research and to promote evidence-based policy. It is evident that this is being undertaken by the project. As a foundation, we also believe in active citizenship at the community level, nationally as well as internationally, in creating safe spaces for human interaction and dialogue, in bringing together alliances and partnerships with civil society organizations and with other national and international institutions. In this project, we have sought to cover our bases on all fronts. I would like to emphasize the stakeholder and outreach aspects of this project. As mentioned, this is our third presentation to Parliament in our third year of the project. Behind the scenes, our Board of Administrators and Board of Governors, between them, bring together experts from many fields. This project's advisory board brought together the National Statistics Office, the World Bank Group, the New Economics Foundation, the London School of Economics and Political Science, and European Commission, whom I thank. We have also collaborated with many organizations in their work on well-being through giving talks, holding workshops and meetings. These include the Malta Employers Association, the Central Bank of Malta, and the Archbishop Seminary. We have also met with several entities who expressed interest in our work, some of which are registered stakeholders in the Index project. We believe they deserve a mention for their collaboration, and in no particular order, we would like to thank the Church Commission for Peace and Justice, the Malta Arts Council, the Nationalist Party and the Malta Labour Party, various ministries, the Malta Chamber of Commerce, the Environment and Resources Authority, the Human Rights Directorate, the Commissioner for Children, local councils, the Legal Aid Agency, the Human Rights Directorate, the Malta Council for the Voluntary Sector, the National Commission for the Promotion and Equality, the Commission for the Rights of Persons with Disability. We are very keen to bring all stakeholders on board and invite any interested entity to enroll in our stakeholder database. On the website, we also have where you will be able to see the stakeholder network and be able to join the network as well. As mentioned by the Pro-Rector, there also exists a body of researchers working on well-being teams in Malta, and we now have links to a repository of research on well-being at the University of Malta. We also invite others to undertake research on well-being and to link their results to our website, wellbeingindex.mt. I also want to share some of the insights that emerged during our stakeholder consultation, which was held on the 14th of November of last year. Attendees highlighted the need to move beyond averages and look at disaggregated information, to pay attention to vulnerable groups in society and their intersectionality. In this respect, any data on well-being ought to capture the experiences of people who form part of different ethnic groups, the LGBTIQ community, those who have a disability, and so on. These discussions raise points on how the plight of minorities may not be captured in national statistics and hidden within national averages. To this end, the consultation meeting brought the consideration of marginalized groups to the fore. This, we hope, will also be a contribution of the project in the months to come, in which we look forward to invite you to participate. I would like to thank the Speaker of the House for welcoming us once again, and all of you for attending to today's event. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. And after those concluding remarks, I thank everyone for the participation and those who are following this important program on Wellbeing Index. Thank you very much. Thank you.